Hello. According to an 11th century Arabic book called The Almanac of Health, an old man went to the doctor complaining of a frigid complexion and stiffness in winter. The doctor, after examining his condition, prescribed a rooster. Being a hot and dry bird, it was the perfect tonic for a cold and rheumatic old man. This is medicine by the four humours, which are black bile, yellow bile, blood and phlegm. The idea that the body is a concoction of these four essential juices is one of the oldest on record. From the ancient Greeks to the 19th century, it explained disease, psychology, habit and personality. When we describe people as being choleric, sanguine or melancholic, we're still using the language of the humours today. It also explains why, in the long and convoluted history of medical practice, pigeon livers were an aphrodisiac, bloodletting was a form of heroism, and why you really could be frightened to death. With me to discuss the four humours are David Wootton, Professor of History at the University of York, Vivian Nutton, Professor of the History of Medicine at University College London, and Noga Arika, Visiting Fellow at the Institut Jean Nicot in Paris. David Wootton, the first record we have of the four humours is a book from the 5th century called The Nature of Man by the Greek Polybus. What, in Polybus' opinion, were the four humours and why did they work?
Well, you've just listed them. They're blood, phlegm, yellow bile and black bile. And before that, there had essentially been three humours. And he invents is perhaps a strong word, but he introduces the fourth humour to line up the humours with the notion that there are four elements, earth, air, fire and water, and that there are four qualities, hot and cold, dry and wet. And so he's got the body in line with Empedocles' views about the universe, which come about 50 years before. And Polybus is the son-in-law of Hippocrates, the great founder of medicine, and he's roughly contemporary with Plato. So that from Plato in his later writings is taking up this way of thinking, and from that it passes into the long medical and philosophical tradition of Western culture.
What did you mean by humours, David, and how did they work? What are we talking about?
Well, they're fluids, so you've got this problem of the notion of a dry fluid, something like a treacle, you might think, and they run all through the body so that they're all present in the blood. So if you tapped some blood from someone and put it in a cup and let it sit for a while, it would separate out into these four humours, and the humour of blood would be one of the four humours within the substance you removed from the veins.
How far was this an abstract concept, which we know the Greeks developed to such a refined extent, and how far was this based on observation?
It's a combination of the two. I mean, obviously, if you think about what comes out of the body, there's blood that comes out if you cut yourself. There's vomit, which is thought of as having bile in it. There's phlegm that drips from your nose. And so there's the notion that these humours are visible in the things that come off the body, and black bile is particularly visible in dark excrement. So they can be seen in daily practice. And the assumption is also that if you cut someone open, you will find them. So you'll find yellow bile in the gall, you'll find black bile in the spleen, you'll find blood coagulated in the liver, and you'll find phlegm in the brain and in the lungs. So they have locations in the body.
What did this mean in practical terms? How did a Greek doctor go about understanding and treating diseases?
Well, the assumption is that if you get the humours into balance, then you have a healthy person. And so health consists in having the correct balance of the humours. Disease is occurs when the humours go out of balance. And then the question is, how do you bring them back into balance? And there are two ways of doing this. One is by feeding the right food to someone. So you feed roosters to someone who's too frigid. And the other is by removing from them the excess of something. And so by letting off the blood, you can let off all four of the humours, but you can also make someone vomit, and that will tend to get rid of the bile. You can give someone a purge and induce diarrhoea, and that will tend to get rid of melancholy or the black bile, and so on. So that the three standard therapies become bloodletting, inducing vomiting and inducing diarrhoea.
Can you just develop this idea of balance or equilibrium a little? Because it's a fascinating one, isn't it? It's the centre of the whole enterprise.
It's the centre of the whole enterprise and its power. It leads to the assumption that, one, you can remove excess to bring things back into balance, and the other is you can treat by opposites. So you can introduce more of something in order to reintroduce the balance. And its power must come, I think, from the fact that the balance, which you weigh things with, the steel yard, is the earliest scientific tool. It's the early, and it's incredibly sensitive, so small changes have big effects on a balance. And that's presumably why the balance becomes the metaphor with which they understand the human body.
Thank you. Vivian Nutton, the idea of four humours wasn't the only theory on offer, as I understand it. Some argued there were five fluids, some said there were 12, but it was Galen later on, five or six centuries after Polybus, who plucked the four humours from then relative obscurity. Can you tell us what he made of them and why he was so significant?
Well, Galen is significant because he turns what is a minority theory into a theory that dominated Western and Eastern medicine for centuries to come. He himself doesn't choose the theory of the four humours. His teachers and their teachers before him had long believed that that theory of the four humours went back to Hippocrates. They didn't know much about Polybus, but they thought the theory was that of Hippocrates, the great doctor in the 5th century. Galen takes up these notions from his teachers, and by a remarkable combination of individual effort, rhetoric, logic, and enormous learning, manages to convince people that this is the only theory worth following.
But you did say at the beginning of your remark that this from relative obscurity, with the idea of the five fluids and the 12 fluids, were they in those six or seven centuries between Polybus and Galen, were they in the ascendance?
There was a whole range of theories. Some people concentrate on fluids, any number of fluids. Some people see things like bile and phlegm as nasty things which are created out of blood. But many people have views of medicine, of the human body, as being based on atoms and pores, on a whole range of different things. And Galen in his time said, of course, there were people who don't believe in any theory whatsoever and just treat people.
So we've got this man, Galen, who wrote, as I understand it, about 200 books, who lived to a great old age. He was an advertisement for his own medicine. And you did express awe yourself. Why were his views, why did they become so extraordinarily authoritative that they were unchallenged for centuries and centuries?
It's, I think, because of his own personality. He, when he writes his books, he is always right. He is incredibly accurate as a debater, as a logician. He sees the bad points of his opponent's views very quickly. He also has a remarkable sense as a doctor of observation. And finally, he was doing things that other people were not, such as carrying out anatomical experiments. And he was a successful doctor who rose to be the emperor's physician in 2nd century AD. So all these together gave a new impetus to Hippocratic medicine, which is what he thought he was teaching. And for reasons we don't entirely know, within 100 years, his theory had become almost totally dominant.
Did he establish an academy like Plato's academy or Aristotle's?
No, as far as we know. He refers to friends, he refers to pupils, but his friends did happen to be the emperor's uncle and the leading politicians of the time.
Did he bring any more evidence to bear about the thing that David Wood was talking about, the notion of the fluids? When you looked in, there were the fluids and blood contained, all the, and so on and so forth. Did he bring more evidence to back up his emphasis on the predominance of the four humours?
He experimented. He believed that one should carry out experiment, and he believed that his own experiments and his clinical practice showed that his view was right and that balance was extremely important and that you could demonstrate that it was something to do with these four fluids.
Noga Rika, how were the four humours, seen to connect with other matters like ageing and astrology? And how did this fit into the scheme of things?
Well, the very idea, the humours, as David was saying before, has something to do, is a way of defining the microcosm of the body in relation to the macrocosm of the world. And humans, are the human microcosm fits into and corresponds to this macrocosm in a very intimate way. So this idea that the human body is entirely part of nature, and so humours were considered just one aspect of nature. They were in a sense, one of the reasons for which they became such established eventually, as Vivian was saying, it became such an established idea and was so easy to transmit, was that you had this idea that each humor, for example, phlegm corresponds to winter time. It's cold. It's wet. That's an idea that eventually became more and more established. Same thing, blood is warm, humid, corresponds to springtime. It also actually happens to be the most positive in the sense of the humors. You have melancholy, black bile, which of course is dry and cold, corresponds to autumn.
But the humours that you have change as you grow older, don't they?
They change
through the day, even. So doctors are in a good position to prescribe, and then they say, no, but that was this morning, you've changed by this evening, or this was not a hot spring, therefore this did. And did it gave them great play inside this system, didn't it?
Yes, it's a system that's at once deterministic and also quite, it allows for quite a lot of freedom. Because on the one hand, the human beings are born under a certain constellation, That corresponds, of course, to a season. That corresponds, therefore, also to a humoral complexion. And so that sense, we are born, each one of us is born with a certain temperament, or complexion is actually more or less synonymous in this case. On the other hand, of course, yes, to each time of day corresponds another humoral state. And women and men, for example, have different humoral complexions. Children's brains are supposed to also be warm and moist, which accounts for their inability to learn. It's the obverse for old age, which also corresponds to evening. So in a sense, all these correspondences are almost, there's something very commonsensical about this vision.
And it fitted in very well with astrology, didn't it? It was a great dominating intellectual matter at the time.
Absolutely. Though it is actually quite a matter of debate to what extent and when and who exactly establishes correspondences between astrological constellations and humoral complexions.
One thing that interested me reading about this was there seemed to be very no difference whatsoever in treating the body or the mind. They run into each other and they were the same thing, which has been such a contentious thing over the last 200 or 300 years, but then for at least over 2,000 years. And so these humours affected the character and the personality. Can you just explain the character traits associated with one or two of the humours?
Well, we still use, as we were saying at the very beginning, as you said in the introduction, we still use those adjectives, choleric, and phlegmatic, melancholic, sanguine, and most of us still know what these adjectives mean. We correspond to certain personality types. The humoral system is holistic for a whole range of reasons. There's actually a very complex theory of the mind that grew, in a sense, alongside or is internal to the development also of humoral theory, though they actually are separate.
What was that?
That might be a subject for a different, for another whole other program. Yeah. But the psychology that developed by Plato and by Aristotle of the seats of the soul has actually a resonance also with the conception, at least the way you conceive how humors work and how they travel from between all the key organs of the body. And the idea was that the three main organs of the body were liver, heart, and brain. And so you have the humors first concocted out of chyle, so to speak, in the stomach, going into the liver, traveling from the liver to the heart. So there's this idea that there was actually vascular connection between liver and heart, which took a very long time to be shown. Actually, this took a very long time to be shown to be completely fictitious. And then from the heart to the brain. And in each one of these organs is also the seat of a type of soul. So the liver is the heart as the seat of the appetitive soul. In a sense, you know, what everything is, you know, our basic desires, our basic needs are that we share also even with the vegetal kingdom. The heart is the seat of the sensitive soul, which is also about perception and so on, which we share with all other animals. And then the brain is the seat of the rational soul, which supposedly we only humans seem to have in a very developed fashion. And so the idea that you have these, then you have these animal, these spirits, vital and sensitive and animal spirits going from one organ to the next.
Would either of you like to comment on this? Because this run out, Vivian.
Well, one of the things that Galen does is take Plato's psychology, which is the three parts, and try and argue that by his own anatomical experiments on animals, he can show that there are three separate systems in the body. And in his view, and this is perhaps one of his main contribution, he strongly insists on the interrelationship of mind and body, not just that if one drinks too much, one's mental facilities are likely to be a little less.
Or sharpened in some cases.
Or sharpened. But the other way round. And that if you suffer from grief, for instance, that has quite a definite impact on your physical condition. And he's the founder of stress diseases.
And of course, humours run through the animal kingdom as well as amongst human beings. So cats are melancholy; they keep to themselves. They're cold, they're dry. Consequently, they're grey furred. The standard Elizabethan cat is a grey tabby. They think a lot. Hares, which according to common law, run with their eyes shut and sleep with their eyes open, are obviously philosophical creatures and also suffer from melancholy. And so you can go through the animal kingdom and identify in any animal which is the predominant humour in that animal. And if you draw a picture of a cat in the 16th century, it always looks miserable because cats are melancholy.
Can we stay with the complexity of it for a moment, David, which Noga took us into a little bit? The system, I loved the complexity of it because it just inhabited every part of thought, didn't it? It took in all that was being thought of at the time, and in the brain, astrology, actually curing somebody or trying to cure somebody. I'm contradicting myself now because it had to be proved, hadn't it? They had to prove that it worked so that people went along with them. They had the bloodletting worked, for instance. How did they sort of hoodwink
people?
Well, in many ways, it's
a self-confirming system. I mean, any medical therapy that you believe in tends to work. So if you treat people, you induce the placebo effect, and people tend to get better. And so doctors through this whole period, from Polybus through until the 19th century, are making their patients feel better because they're paying attention to them. And to some degree, bloodletting does make you feel better. It tends to lower your temperature. It tends to give you a good night's sleep. And so you feel better after having your blood let. The fact that it's probably done you in the long run more harm than good isn't something the patient's going to be aware of. The patient is going to feel that they've improved through the bloodletting.
Younger.
Yes, actually, it's very good if you have a high blood pressure, but maybe not so good if you're a pregnant woman. But though they also did bloodlet pregnant women, which was maybe not such a good idea, and some people did die. But no, the point I think one of the reasons for which it seemed to work, and I think is also the rhetorical force of the expert. There's a trust and expertise. A doctor has read many books, and that is, in a sense, reason enough to trust in the doctor. There's this idea of high knowledge that is going to help your lowly body, in a sense.
This established by Galen, as you emphasised, Vivian Nutton, went into the Christian medicine and then went into the Arabic world. In Baghdad, a man called Ibn Butlan wrote The Tables of Health, and then we had Avicenna, who elaborated the four humours very extensively and did his listings, his famous listings. Can you tell us when it transferred there, was it added to? It was still practiced, so we're still pushing on with that thing sort of set in motion by Galen.
One of the great advantages of the humoral scheme is it's so flexible and it can be added to. And Galen himself is rather inconsistent. He talks, he doesn't write. Most of his books are actually dictated. And when we talk, we make mistakes. His successors tried to eliminate all his contradictions and added to what he had said more and more and more of these correspondences, which in a sense amount to proof. The astrology comes in after Galen. And all his successors are doing, or if you like, elaborating that system, trying to iron out the inconsistencies and produce something which is both perfectly obvious, we can see things changing, and also provides the doctor with the ultimate get-out, which is that if something goes wrong, it's not necessarily the doctor's fault, but of something that was beyond his control that suddenly turned out. So not only have you doctors saying, we can cure you and look at all the patients we have cured, but we also have them with very good explanations for why they fail to cure you.
I rather got ahead of myself there, because before he came to the Arab world, it was taken up by the Christians in Syria. And so it went through the various religions of the Middle East, didn't it?
One reason for which the system, especially Galen's version of all this, was so acceptable to the monotheistic peoples, of Europe and the Middle East, was that his thinking is teleological in the sense that he thinks in terms of final causes, in terms of the final purpose of a function. So, for example, instead of having eyes in order to see, you see because you have eyes. He turns on its head this idea, that the idea of our contemporary idea, of course, of evolution. I mean, it's this idea that really everything is there for a purpose. And so that, of course, makes a lot of room for the idea of a God and for what we would call today intelligent design. With an idea, we are, of course, always tempted to think in those terms. And Galen was very, very good at tucking his thinking into that scheme.
Avicenna, it seemed to me, took it up very emphatically, David Wharton. Did he give it more energy to power it on for another few centuries because of the way he elaborated it?
Yes, and I mean,
because he was a hugely important influence in medicine, wasn't he?
Yes, and there's this whole process of crystallizing what Galen has said and formulating it, as Vivian was saying, and formulating it in clear and straightforward ways so that it becomes the standard teaching in the universities. And as universities are formed in the 13th century, it becomes part of the basic curriculum, which becomes uniform across Europe.
And so it then pushes into the European universities in the early Middle Ages. And what are they doing with that theory then? How are they still experimenting?
Well, experimenting is an interesting word here. I mean, I think it was clear from what Vivian is saying. Doctors go around saying, look at all the people we've cured. Of course, what they don't do is count the number of people who've died under their care. Counting only comes in the 19th century and destroys this whole way of thinking. But what they certainly do from the middle of the 15th century is begin to engage in careful anatomical dissection and begin to study the details of the construction of the body. This is the great work of Vesalius above all, and what they then show is that Galen in lots of details is wrong. Galen had by and large dissected apes rather than human beings. But all that anatomical study doesn't disconfirm the theory about the fluids that are running through the body, because what Vesalius is looking at is the hard structures in the body, and his study of that is compatible with retaining all the theory about the fluids that flow through those structures.
In a sense, the sections, as you just said, start happening in the 14th century again. They had actually been forbidden, even under Galen, the dissections of humans, that is. And that, of course, does, as you just said, changes a lot. But it's also interesting to think of the fact that if you don't have a map with which to read the body won't tell you very much. And so even at the beginning, in the 14th century, they were dissecting, finally looking at the brain, for example. It's very hard to look at a brain, really, because it does collapse quite quickly. But they were still reading into what they saw some of Galen's own perceptions. For example, the idea of the rete mirabile, the miraculous network at the base of the brain, which the humans actually don't have. And that idea actually held on for another couple of centuries, as you said, until Vesalius.
Can we talk about this document called The Lily of Medicine, which is an early medieval document? David, would you like to talk about that? Vivian, you're passing it around the table. I wish, but for a fleeting moment, instantly dismissed, it would have been nice to be on television. It was rather like it went across the three-quarter line, like the old blacks, that one. Right, Vivian.
Now for the touchdown. The Lily of Medicine was a university textbook, which was then translated as appears in various forms and systematizes, if you like, in Western Europe in the 14th century and later, the views, the humoral views. Doesn't involve anatomy except very basic anatomy, but it provides you with the if you like, the handbook for the doctor for what he should look for, how he should treat, and was very common. And so it penetrated from universities down into the local languages and helped to spread the knowledge, if you like, down to people who are literate but not Latinate.
We've actually slightly missed over the, I have, escaped the idea, and avoid the idea of diet, which played a big part in this, didn't it, Noga?
Very much so. The key book that was a product, perhaps, of the Salernitan School of Medicine in the Middle Ages was the Regiment Sanitatis Sanitatum, which was a book that was translated into many languages indeed, in all the vernacular languages, which was a handbook to how to lead your life in humoral terms, necessarily in humoral terms. So, for example, when to eat, what to eat, when to have sex, when not, when to have a phlebotomy, when not, whether to have beer after a meal or not, whether to go for a walk and why you should in a certain time of day after a meal, how somebody who's fat should exercise, somebody who's thin should exercise. All these ideas, very precise guidelines about how to lead your life in very practical terms.
Just let's take the diet briskly first. Does it make sense to us today, what they're saying there?
Profoundly, this idea, again, I mean, the idea of balance, of course, makes complete sense. It's a commonsensical idea. And so diet is one very potent form of medicine, given, of course, that what we eat has a direct effect on our organism and on the state of our humors. For example, there are hundreds and thousands of examples, but most medical recipes actually are dietary recipes. They're culinary recipes, in a sense. They're telling the patient, well, for example, if you're all melancholy, you should have nenuphar, veal, avoid red meat, avoid lettuce, and so on. And of course, each doctor will have their own opinion in a way.
And in great detail. I mean, Burton's Anatomy of Melancholy contains long discussion of this. You should eat pike but not carp. You should eat partridge but not duck, and so on. Every bird, every creature, every vegetable has a different humoral effect on you.
Yes, you brought that up again, as you did earlier, which was very helpful, the pervasiveness of this inside the culture, and it pervaded into literature. In England, you got Ben Jonson's Every Man in His Humour, and in Julius Caesar, Brutus says, "Must I give way to your rash choler?" So, just as an example, when Hamlet says to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, "I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, forgone all custom of exercises," how would the doctors of the time have diagnosed him, and what would they have prescribed?
Well, Hamlet, I think, tells us exactly what's wrong with him. Not taking exercise leads to melancholy. He says, when the ghost appears to him, that he's melancholic, and perhaps if you've got melancholy, that leads to madness, that leads to visions. Perhaps he's suffering from insanity, and that's why he's seeing ghosts. He also says that he's pigeon-livered and without gall. That's to say he's not got enough choler. That's why he can't take revenge. So Hamlet, we know, is suffering from melancholy, that's to say from black bile, and he's got too little yellow bile, he's got too little choler. And the result of that is that he's become philosophical, he's become self-obsessed, he goes around talking to himself, he reads too many books, and we know therefore exactly how he would walk. He would walk very slowly, looking down at the ground as he walked. He'd probably be carrying a book. We know that his hair would be lank and straight, because people with curly hair are choleric.
This is getting very close to home for a lot of our listeners.
We know that he'd have no beard on his chin and no hair on his chest. So as soon as Hamlet walks on the stage, the audience would be able to tell by looking at him what his humoral complexion is, and then he would perform that humour for them. And so they would see him as a medical type, in the same way that we might think of as someone who's manic depressive. We might recognise them when they appear on the stage and say, oh, those are the symptoms of mania. So when Elizabethan audience saw Hamlet, they would think at once, that's a melancholic character, and then everything he did would conform to that.
Excellent. Can I now come back, Vivian, to how Galen is beginning to be displaced? Vesalius' Anatomy discovers over 200 errors in Galen, and there's there's this diagnosis of urine going on quite extensively. What does that bring to the argument?
That's an urine diagnosis is an interesting question, because in Galen you have relatively little about urine, but by 400 AD, his successors had brought together all his information on urine and were writing books on how to examine the urine. And urine is still a very important diagnostic aid. When you get to the 16th century, with the rediscovery of Galen's original works, urine diagnosis by itself moves from being something of the great doctor, the university-trained doctor, to something which is practiced by the quack. And it's very interesting in art to see that pictures of university doctors in the 15th century carry urine flasks. The end of the 16th century, it is the quack standing in the marketplace. And urine diagnosis quickly moves from being something which is highly learned to something which is the quack. So that's irrelevant in a sense.
But is this all signalling that the great era of Galen is coming to an end, David Wharton? And you would have thought it would come to an end in 1628 when Harvey published his discovery of blood, the circulation of blood, but it doesn't seem to have done. It's a long, lingering death, if indeed it's gone at all, this theory.
This is one of the great intellectual mysteries. Once Harvey has shown that the blood is circulating rapidly through the body, the traditional theory of the humours, which assumes that everything moves very slowly, it ebbs and flows, that the body is a sort of great brewer's vat, bubbling up all these substances, essentially cooking them. That's what concoction means. That should all disappear and be replaced by a mechanical idea of what's happening. And very much in theory, in the late 17th century, you get understandings of the body as a mechanism, and Lemaître in the 18th century is talking about the body as a machine. And yet alongside that goes exactly the same medical therapies, phlebotomy or bloodletting, emetics, introducing vomiting, and so on. And because the therapies survive, because medicine continues to be practiced very largely unchanged, the language preserves, and to some degree, the assumption is still that these temperaments and humours are still present. And so there's a real disjunction between the understanding of physiology and the understanding of character, temperament and therapy.
Maybe. But it's also true that Harvey, in fact, himself thought that his discovery had strengthened Galen's medicine by showing just how drugs could be transported around the body by blood. But the other point is that Galen disappears, if you like, from the medical universe in the end of the 16th century to be replaced by Hippocrates. And Hippocrates is seen by Galen and by the others as the founder of the four humours. And so one can abolish Galenic medicine while still retaining all those Hippocratic notions of balance. And you then concentrate on Hippocrates.
Now, can we talk about Descartes, who was a contemporary of Harvey, and his bringing into play the notion that the mind and body were separate entities? How did this play with regard to the four humours?
Well, Descartes actually was less of a dualist than the Cartesians. And even though he needed to insist on the dual and the separation of mind and body for methodological purposes, in the end, the conjunction of both, the idea of the physiological mind, re-entered his system. The idea that actually our mind is made of bodily substance in some level, more specifically, that our emotions are physiological, and that they inform also our rational soul. That old idea holistic idea. He did hold on to it very much in his treatise on the passions, for example. When he wrote about the passions, he was actually writing in a very similar way to the way in which his predecessors had written. On the other hand, he also did, it's true, the body that he described was a mechanistic body. But a mechanistic body can also accommodate the hydraulic idea, the idea that you have humors circulating or moving around in some way or other in a hydraulic organism. And so, in a sense, if you visualize the idea of an emotion going up to your brain and then triggering some event in your brain, then you become aware of this emotion. That's a very basic and rather silly way of looking at how emotional consciousness works. But it sort of worked as well. It sort of functioned as an idea.
One of the interesting things about this stage, the 17th and 18th century, David Wharton, is there's still, you have intellectual almost dismantlement, practical with Vesalius, people challenging this idea, but still it goes on at the highest level. I mean, George Washington, famously, it was called he was treated by a doctor who called himself a heroic bloodletter, and he thought that this heroic bloodletting hastened on the death of George Washington. So it's still being practiced.
Heroic in this context is a technical term. It means letting someone's blood until they lose consciousness. And so heroic bloodletting, as it were, takes them, you have to be a brave doctor to do it, because you have to take them close to the point of death. And there's lots of disputes going on at the time about how much blood you should let. Traditional therapists believe that you should let out considerable quantities, and Washington in likelihood dies as a consequence of that.
Why has this, it's a point that I've been preparing for this program, just kept intriguing me again. Why did this grip on study of medicine hold for so many intelligent people in so many different parts of the world for so long? And it sort of put, almost froze any development of this area of knowledge. Instead of growing up, as it were, it went laterally and brought in all sorts of other things, as you said, and enjoyed itself with partridges and pigeons and plants and goodness knows what. Why was that?
Well, I think one answer is that it is so powerful in the sense that it's invested in every aspect of people's lives. It's very hard to give up something that's invested in every aspect of your life, that makes sense of everything you do, explains all your behaviour, it tells you what to eat, tells you when to take exercise, explains to you your sexual appetites and so on. It's very hard to abandon an idea that's as useful and powerful as that. I think there are two things that are required to step outside this humoral world. One is to move into a world of statistics where you start counting and seeing whether therapies actually have beneficial impacts or not by comparing different types of treatment. And that happens primarily from the 1820s on. And as soon as that happens, all these old therapies come into question. And the other is you need an alternative theory. And the alternative theory that takes over eventually is the germ theory. And one of the interesting things is not only in 1628 do you have Harvey on the circulation of the blood, but you also by then have the microscope, and you can actually see germs, and you could actually in principle begin to study processes like putrefaction and see that putrefaction is a living process. But for anyone coming out of this Hippocratic Galenic tradition, putrefaction is a humoral process, and putrefaction is the result of an excess of a humor. And they have no notion that diseases are living organisms that inhabit the body. They assume that diseases are malfunctions of the body from excessive humors. To move from the notion of the unbalanced body to the notion of the infection requires a whole mental revolution, which proves to be very difficult.
There's also the point that in the middle of the 19th century, one stopped looking at the body as a whole, and one concentrated on looking at individual parts right down to cells. And that makes it very difficult to think in terms of that holistic Galenism, that holistic Hippocratic view. And that was, I think, one of the reasons why, if you like, academic medicine from the 1830s, 40s, 50s moved away from looking at the body as a whole to looking at individual bits and how they functioned. And once you're at that level, then humours become very, very problematic.
There we go. Yes, do you want to come in?
Yes, absolutely. There's the idea of infection. Just to go back very 1 second, the idea of infection. There is a possibility of talking about the body isn't only producing, it's not only self-sufficiently enclosed, the humoral body. It's also very much part of the environment. And one of the key Hippocratic texts had been Airs, Waters, Places. And that's a text that, in a sense, still makes sense today. It's the idea that we are very much, our bodies are very much affected by the environment, by where we live, the latitude where we live, by the climate, and so on. And so you still have, that's another reason why the therapy is based on at least an awareness of where you live and how cold is the water where you live, for example, what air you are breathing, the idea of miasma, why that idea survives. And I think there is, of course, a cutoff point between the holistic body and then the mechanistic body, as you were just saying, the body being cut off into little pieces. But there, I think the continuum, I do think, continues between the body very much and within its environment, and then this idea that the therapies have to be based at least on that awareness.
Maybe not. But if one looks at infection, there are some wonderful sociological studies done in the 60s and 70s in Darkest Finchley, which showed that, in fact, patients were found greater ease in accepting notions of germs and bacteria if they were married to notions of old humoral notions. I was out in the rain and it was cold and I didn't have my hat on. Or I was in the sun and I got hot and that is why I developed tummy trouble. And so it's perfectly possible for, if you like, a humoral view to be combined with the infection view.
We talked about the way that it carried in the language of, let's call it Shakespeare's time, David. No, we are sadly running out of time now, because we are running out of time. It's very much in the language now, as Noga pointed out. It's still there. That's usually an indication that things are still active, isn't it? Do you think the idea of the four humours has not been banished beyond the microscope?
Well, I think, as Noga implied, there's a desire to return to a holistic therapy and a therapy that understands the complexity of human beings and the relationship between mind and body. I think it's very easy to sentimentalize Hippocratic and Galenic medicine. Very often, you didn't go to a Galenic or a Hippocratic doctor. You sent a sample of urine to him, and he diagnosed you simply by looking at the color of your urine. We have 18th century doctors in Germany who specialize in treating women patients who regularly never met the women they treated. They treated them on the basis of letters brought by their servants. So the notion that this was a personalized medicine, I think, can be very much overstated. It was often done by rote in the way that modern medicine is done, by looking up the textbook and saying, well, you've got this condition and therefore this is the therapy. But I think there is a quest in our society for a more personal, a more intimate, a more individualized medicine. And so people have a tendency to turn back to this as a form of that.
And do you think there's any chance that they will turn back? It will be useful again, Naga?
Not the idea of the four humours per se, but as David just said, there's the idea of, the holistic organism, the popularity of alternative therapies today certainly bears witness to this. People are more and more dissatisfied with the mechanization of the body and want to understand what are the relations between all these parts, all these illnesses between body and mind. So that, together with the idea of balance, the popularity of spas and so on, speaks to very much what the humoral therapists, at least, were trying to get at.
Vivian.
It's also true, it answers one important question: why do I fall ill?
The humorous thing does,
yes. Because it's my individual makeup that makes me susceptible.
I'm going to leave it. I can't think of a better ending than that. Why do I fall ill? We can all ask that of ourselves. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Noga Erika. Thank you, David Wharton and Vivian Notton. Next week, it's the Nicene Creed, the testament of the Christian faith, arrived at partly at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. Thank you very much for listening.